The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to City Bible Forum today. Thank you so much for being here. Today is the beginning of a two-part series with Ian Powell. Today's talk is Christmas Unleashed, The Naked Truth of Christmas. Too good to be true and too big to handle. Enjoy the talk today and also next week with Christmas Unpacked. It's part of the series for Christmas for adults only. My name is Russell Matthews. I want to welcome you today and just kind of give you briefly what you should expect today if it's the first time coming along or also has been a while since you've been here. Today, after just a few brief announcements, I'm going to read through just a portion of John that's on the inside of your outline. And Ian's going to come up and give a talk for about 20, 25 minutes or so. During that time, we encourage you to take down any notes that you'd like. But if you do have questions, which after today's talk, I'm sure you will, write down your questions on the small slip of paper that's on the inside of your outline. It's a small slip, small short one. Write your questions down. We'll pick those up afterwards. And then after some other announcements, kind of announcing some of the things that are going to be happening for next year, Ian will come back up and answer as many of the questions that we have within the time allotted. Our goal will be to have you out of here by 10 to the hour. So if you want to go ahead and open up your outline, I'm going to start at the sentence mark number one, read the first paragraph, and then also the last paragraph of John that we have available to us. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made, without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The Word became flesh, and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth.
Well, happy Christmas. We're getting close to Christmas. I'm a Christmasophile. I love Christmas. What's not to love? I reckon there's it's fun giving presents. It's fun getting presents. As you can see, I'm not averse to eating, so I'm always happy to have an excuse to eat some fine food and to have a good reason to drink high-quality cordial or whatever it is that you drink when you're eating fine food. A chance to catch up with, well, most of the families, okay, and friends. It's just a good time. It's sunny. We've got great plans for our Christmas. We're going to borrow a friend's boat and we're going sailing and we're hoping it's going to be fine and that you won't read about us in the Boxing Day papers. But people talk about the magic of Christmas and there is a lot of fun. I know it's, for some people, Christmas is also a mixed blessing for all sorts of reasons. People talk about the magic of Christmas and sometimes they pat Christmas on the head and say it's all about the children, which is a nice way for adults to say, I've got no idea what's going on, but I hope the kids have a good time. But there really is a magic about Christmas, a real hard-edged magic about Christmas. The story about Mary and donkey and the Joseph and the baby and no room for this pregnant woman about to give birth and being stuck in the shed with the pets or the barn with the animals and this dopey tradesman being the only person who can... I'm not the tradesman, a dopey, you know that, but the tradesman, then they had no idea about midwifery. Modern-day husbands often know more about what's going on than they did back then. It's a miserable story. Then they leave as political refugees because Herod the Great, who we know from history was a murderous, horrible piece of work in so many ways, takes a dislike to where Jesus is heading, so he leads to Egypt as a political refugee. It's a dark story in many ways. But people are right to speak about the magic of Christmas. There is something, there's a reason why Christians called Christmas a feast day. Not a bad thing for modern day Christians, if there are any of you here, to get back into the older Christian tradition of really feasting, living up on Christmas. If there's a day when you ought to spend up big and buy the best quality frozen turkey or whatever it is you're going to buy, it's Christmas. Because the real heart of Christmas is unspeakably great. It's, as I've mentioned, as you can hear in the title, it's almost too good to be true. But because something is good doesn't mean it's a myth. The real central fact of Christianity, of Christmas, and the thing that makes it so exciting, is in this very weird word that I've discovered less people than I would have thought knew what this word meant. So I mentioned it to a member of my family, and to my surprise, she didn't know what it meant. I mentioned it to a very clever lawyer friend of mine, and he didn't know what it meant, although he's a great student in a sort of slightly hostile way of some things about Christianity. And it's this word, incarnation. Christmas is about the incarnation. And that's a thrilling word. There's a great lady called Dorothy Sayers, if you're a reader. Her books are fantastic. She's a great academic from the middle of the 20th century. And she says this, "The incarnation is the most dramatic thing that ever entered into the mind of man. But if you tell people that, they stare at you in bewilderment." It's an interesting observation, and if it was true when she wrote it, it's probably triply true now in 2010 in Australia, that there is no more dramatic idea that has ever entered the human mind than that of incarnation. But most people, when you talk about it, think, what's so exciting? Partly because they don't know what you're talking about, and secondly because even if they do, they don't appreciate the two halves that balance together make this so extraordinary. So I thought we'd spend some time together as adults trying to fathom the unfathomable. I'm going to try and describe the undescribable, so we're all going to go out of here confused, which is why I think Russell said we need time for questions, and we'll have some for that. Now, I thought we'd look at this business of the incarnation by looking at the simple, single, clearest, most concise statement about it anywhere in the 66 books of the Bible, and that's in that last verse that Russell read for us. And we're going to see that the incarnation is an idea that feels too big to be true. Your brain is going to, you know, be like your the inbox that says, no, I can't receive this email, it's too big. It's going to take up all the space for the entire year. It's just going to reject it because this idea is big. And it can seem too good to be true. And it's so bigly good that we're going to go into the goodness part of it again next week in the second half. So let's look firstly at this incarnation. I'm aware I haven't defined it yet, and I will soon. Firstly, this thing about the incarnation and Christmas is it seems too big to handle, the idea. And you can see it in the first four words of verse 14, the one in dark type. The Word became flesh. Now, we need to put some flesh on those words so we can... Sorry, that was bad, wasn't it? But we need to sort of spell out these words so we can get a sense of the... wonder of this great event and fact of Christmas. Well, what does it say? The Word, this being, well, if those of you who were with us at the beginning of the year, we spent a bit of time in John 1, but those of you who aren't, it wasn't. It'll be better this time anyhow. But the Word, something happens to the Word. Let's have a look at that. Well, what is this thing called the Word? Well, if you have a look at the only other time it's used in quite this way is in verse 1 of this same chapter. Always with the Bible, you read something, what on earth does that mean? The way to understand it is not to dredge back through our recently constructed minds, but to read it in context. It's a fairly straightforward book, the Bible, particularly if you just read it in its context. So let's have a look at this only other time when the Word is used quite this way in the Bible. Verse 1 of the same chapter, beginning at the top of the left-hand side of the page there. Four things we're going to look at about this Word, who becomes flesh. There are at least seven different things. We're just going to look at four. The first thing, in the beginning was the Word. Well, what do we know about the Word? Whatever this thing, person, force, whatever it is. We know about that from in the beginning was the Word. That is, you go back to whatever you think was the beginning before the Big Bang, whatever it was, whatever you think the beginning was, whatever beginning there is behind other beginnings, and the Word was there. There was never a time when this being, the Word, was not. In the beginning was the Word. Now, this is a direct lift and echo of the first couple of words in the entire Bible, Genesis 1, verse 1, well known. In the beginning, God. But what John, who completely believes that, remember the man who wrote this is Jewish, his DNA is Jewish, his culture is Jewish, his education is Jewish, he knows all about Genesis 1. In the beginning, God. He says, let me tell you something, not in contradiction to that, but as well as that. At that beginning was the Word. Now, if you read through Genesis 1, the Word plays an extraordinary part in Genesis 1. You can do that in your own sort of homework fun. And in case you're in any doubt about that, he echoes it again in verse 2. Verse 1, in the beginning was the Word. Verse 2, he was with God in the beginning. So there's no mistaking it. That's the first thing. He's eternal. The second thing about the Word is his companionship. What was he doing? The Word was with God. Right? So instead of just thinking about God as some sort of, if I can use this word, this sort of lonely, monolithic oneness, this monad, there was actually some person, some thing called the Word who was with God at the beginning. A bit like, you know, you can think of the earth has the moon, the sun has the planets. There's just this companionship here, though they're not very good parallels in some ways. So the Word was eternal. He was with God. He wasn't roaming around his own. He was always this dynamic, and the preposition is very strong in the sense of leaning in towards. They were in close relationship. And most shockingly and scandalously of all is the next statement. The Word was not only with God from the beginning, the Word was God. This is either a sick joke or blasphemy, or it's surprising but sober truth. That the oneness of God is a complex unity, as much oneness is. So this is this person who is the Word. This is the person who becomes flesh. He is God. And in case there's any doubt at all, look at verse 3. John being a good monotheist, a good Jew, this is the distinctive thing about the God of the Bible. It is not true of many of the gods of the earth, without commenting on whether or not they're true or not. But it's just one of the sort of common myths that Westerners have, that all religions, when they talk about God, are talking about the Creator. That's just factually nonsense. An enormous amount of gods that people worship. I mean, the Greek gods, for example, at the time, they weren't the creators. They might have engaged in various parts of it, but there's no answer to the question of creation. The Greek gods are part of the creation, just made of the finest matter. But Jews know that the mark of God is that he's the creator. So look at what he says in verse 3 about the Word. Speaking about the Word. Through him, all things were made. And in case you don't get it in the positive, he says it in the negative. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. You can't find anything that has been made that wasn't made through the Word. Every mountain, every star, every galaxy, every drop of water, all comes through the Word. This is the eternal, unimaginably vast God. Whatever view I have of God, and my view of God has grown over the years, and I'm thankful for that, it is still a pathetic pygmy view of God compared to the real, transcendent, mighty, mind-boggling nature of this being. The universe itself is over-engineered, it seems to us, but that's, I think, partly because it will say to us, you think that's big, sits in the palm of God's hand, right? That's small. And what it says here is the Word becomes flesh. That is, well, what does the word incarnate mean? Oh, at last. Thanks, Sam. You're finally going to get around to it. Now, here it is. Ever heard of a dish called chili con carne? It's chili with meat. That's all that means in the original. Most of us here are carnivores. A carnivore eats flesh. Eats meat. The carn part of incarnation means flesh, meaty stuff. And incarnation means something is infleshed, right? You are an incarnate being. That's what we are. We live. We have this fleshy existence. That's the way God designed you to be, right? If he wanted you to be a pure spirit, that's what you'd be. But he has better plans than that. And what it's saying is this Word that was with God and was God and created all things, there came this unimaginable, unasked for moment when the Word became flesh. It is where, and I know this is a shocking thing to say if we understand what the first part, it's where God Almighty shows his great greatness in that he allows himself to become small and to become a fetus. To become a baby in utero, to be born, to be dependent in a way that God in himself is never dependent on the nursing mother, this Palestinian peasant girl. He needs to have his nappy changed. It is shocking for anyone who understands the first half, and John and the early Christians are not unaware of the shock. This is why the great Dorothy Sayers says it is the most dramatic idea to enter the mind of a human being. The Bible and the Old Testament will often contrast God with flesh. These are sort of opposite poles. Psalm 56, "In God I have trusted. I fear not what flesh can do to me," speaking of the most powerful of human beings. All that it means, well, it's actually not just all that it means to be human, but John in the Greek had a number of words he could have used. The word became a human. He could have used that. He could have used the word, the word became a, entered a body. And body is a nice word. You know, bodies are magnificently designed things, but he doesn't. He deliberately chooses, as it were, the crassest, weakest, crudest word he can have to express the animal nature of humanity. Flesh. Meat. Look, I like to kid myself, and I think I'm looking fairly neat today. Okay, I've got my newish suit on. I've just fabulous on my shirt. I've got my newest shoes on. I had a wash. I've got my skin on. I could look a lot worse. Now, you imagine if you took the skin off, if I was sitting here with no skin on. It's a creepy picture, isn't it? Because underneath the neatness of the skin is all this moisture and fluids and tiny bits of fat, in my case, massive amounts of muscle, right? Tendon, cartilage, all this stuff that is kind of creepy. We have a natural aversion if we see a body that's been ripped open. It's kind of, right? And that's what flesh involves. It's very clearly chosen. God wants us to know that when this God enters humanity, he doesn't seem to be a human. It's not some sort of avatar, some sort of illusion, where it looks like a man, but it isn't really a man. It's really a God. Right? Or it's just a divinely inspired man. The difficulty of Christianity is, and it took the Christians a couple hundred years before they finally took a deep breath and swallowed it and said, we have to live with a massive paradox in exactly the same way as we've learnt to do in the last 100 years in physics. It's so much easier to believe in the God of the Bible, the God that's really revealed through Jesus now, thanks to the fact we now realise that science is not a simple, straightforward business. We're constantly stuck with things that hard to get our heads around, particularly when you get into the area of quantum mechanics and quantum physics. It's a wacky world down there, the tiny products. Light, you know, we've been through this. Light travels, you know, it moves as waves and it moves as photons. It can't be both, but doggone it, it is. And you don't say, I don't believe in light, and you don't pretend it's one thing and not the other. You just say, we know light's real. We really haven't got a working model yet. We probably will. We're clever. So it is with God. Jesus is the only person who lives his life truly man and truly God. Fully man, flesh. Fully God. The two have become one. The incarnation. As it says in Colossians 2, in Christ, listen to these words, he said, all the fullness of deity lives in bodily form. It's a similar attempt to try to bring the unbringable together. All the fullness of deity, not partly deity, not he's sort of a bit gaudy, lives in bodily form. This is the great central miracle of the incarnation, and it explains all the subsequent ones. That's why this person could do the things that he could do, that only he could do. That's why he could command nature when he chose to. That's why he could raise the dead. That's why he could heal bodies and recreate them. That's why he could turn water into wine, because that's what he does in his capacity as the one who is God and man. And what does he do? He comes and the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. He wasn't just a flesh. Oh, there he goes. Did you see that? No. He rented a unit. He found an apartment in your neighborhood and he dwelt among us. He wanted to live amongst us. Right? The word that's used, the dwelling, is a particularly odd word in the original, and it goes back to that great moment when God had rescued Israel out of Egypt and they were living in tents as they were heading off to the Promised Land. One of the great pictures of the Christian life. We've been saved, but we ain't home yet, but we're heading away. And what does God say to Moses? Moses doesn't suggest this to God. Never cross your mind to suggest this to God. God says to Moses, Moses, I want you to build me a tent, a tabernacle, and put it in the middle of the camp of the Israelites. And it will symbolically say that I'm living with them. I'm traveling. But they couldn't see him. He was the invisible God still. But this is the word that's used. The word became flesh and actually visibly, touchably lived amongst us. And that's where the virgin birth comes in, doesn't it? I mean, I read lots of books attacking Christianity, lots of websites, and they go on and on about the virgin birth in a way that Christians frankly don't. It's not at the centre of our faith at all. It's only mentioned in two of the four Gospels. The really silly websites say, oh, the other two guys don't even know about it. I mean, really. It's mentioned in two of the four. John clearly knows that Jesus' birth is miraculous. The virgin birth is one way that God could have done it. I take it God could have got this human being living with us that was fully human and fully God in other ways. That's the way he does it, which makes it very clear it's through a real woman. But God was involved from the very beginning. We believe in the virgin birth because we know that Jesus is God's son. We don't believe that Jesus is God's son because of the virgin birth. So if you could, in theory, which you can't, disprove the virgin birth, it actually, nothing much crumbles. It just seems to be the way that God has done it. We do need to move along, unfortunately. This idea is big, it's enormous, and there's a tendency for our little computers to go, that's going to damage the hardware and the software, I'm just going to throw that idea out. It's too big to handle. Because it really is about, as it were, catching the Pacific Ocean in all its magnificence in perhaps a small drink bottle, saying, there's the Pacific Ocean, it's all there. I mean, I do love having a look outside from a little tinny and sometimes from the cliffs. You look out at the Pacific Ocean, just the part you can see is so huge, isn't it? I mean, there's so much water there, and I think so much fish waiting there to be caught. And I realise that that's nothing, isn't it? The Pacific Ocean is so big, but to have it all in one little bottle, that's something like the Word becoming flesh. Or having all the power of hurricanes in a little Vegemite jar. You think, it can't happen. No, it does seem absurd, but that is what's going on with Jesus. And that's what makes sense of all the other strange stuff that goes on around this once in the human history visit from God himself. Now, Larry King, some of you will know, he's quite old and distinguished now. You can either know him as the man who married and married and married and married, or you can know him as the king of interviewers, CNN, etc. They reckon that he has interviewed about 40,000 people, which is a lot of interviews. But he was interviewed once, and he was asked this. He was asked, if you could choose anyone from human history, who would you ask? Now, you know the answer is Jesus, don't you? Because otherwise I wouldn't have brought it up. If it was Fred Smith, the local butcher, why would I waste your time with it? But Larry King, Jewish by background, says the person he'd like to interview is Jesus Christ. The interviewer then asked the interviewer, what would you like to ask him? Larry King replied, I would like to ask him if he was indeed virgin born. The answer to that question, Larry King says, would define history. So you see, and I think there's a lot of wisdom. He's saying, if indeed Jesus is the incarnate Son of God, shorthand for that is virgin born, it would make everything different. Well, we're over the rest of a few minutes now and then next week going to look at some of the great differences. And this part where it gets almost too good to be true, that God would do that. What does it say about God? What does it say about God's concern and interest in us in this tiny, tiny little broken planet? What it says in John 1:14 is, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory. Glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Right? Because he came and lived with us, people like John and us through his eyes can actually see his glory and watch him. And therefore the great longing that humans have, that sometimes we give up on and despair on, to really know what is real and true and ultimate about life. What is light as against darkness, truth as against fantasy. Is answerable because God has become a human being. We can now go to this human being and find out what God is like, which is why he is called in Matthew chapter 1, Emmanuel. Emmanuel. It's not just a beautiful name, but in Matthew chapter 1, verse 23, you have the name, then we're given the Hebrew meaning of it, which means God with us. You can go to God with us. Not just a man with theories about God, but Jesus will show us, tell us what is true about you, about God, about us. People go to meet Jesus the man. They get uncomfortable. They're actually meeting God. They go to hear Jesus the man. And according to Jesus, they're hearing God. And one of the most shocking verses that I realize is becoming one of my favorites, in John 14, the night before Jesus dies, people go to see Jesus, and what do they see? Well, Philip says to Jesus, "We'd just like to see God." You remember Jesus' extraordinary answer, without parallel in human history. Jesus says to Philip, "Philip, have I been with you for so long and you don't know who I am? If you have seen me, you have seen the Father." That is unimaginable. Who thinks that? No one except this one who is God incarnate. Well, we can now know what God is like. And along with that, you may know the saying, that's mysterious. The more I've tried to understand what it means, the more mysterious it becomes. Not a God statement. This is Marshall McLuhan's statement. The famous, "The medium is the message," which I've discovered doesn't mean almost anything like what I assumed it meant. In fact, I don't know why he says it like that, because it doesn't mean what you think it means. At least as far as I can understand the McLuhan equation. But let me use it in its most obvious sense. The medium, that is, the way in which the communication comes to you, is the message. If ever that was true, it's true of Jesus. Because it's not just that Jesus comes to bring us some ideas about God, some corrections about life after death and things like that, if you're brave enough to listen to him, he'll do that. But there's something about the way that God is communicating that says an enormous amount about the living and the true God. The medium is the message. That he does not just send a prophet. He'd done that beforehand. You can read the works of the prophets, Isaiah, Zechariah, etc. God had sent the prophets. God doesn't send a book. He comes personally, the Word that was God, that was with the Father from the very beginning. God comes personally. It indicates the passionate intensity of the personal nature of God's love for us. He doesn't want us to know facts about God so we can obey him. He wants to meet with us. He wants you to know him and therefore to trust and love him. And so the medium is the message. In a very real sense, the great present of Christmas is the presence. That's a bit corny, isn't it? But the present is the presence. It's not the presence of a great one. It's the presence of the greatest one. It's the presence of God himself. That says to us something about what God is like. We'll look at that more next week. Great theme going through the Bible of God's longing to be with his people. He walks with Adam and Eve in the cool of the evening. He gets Moses to build him a tent. At the end of time, in the new heaven and the new earth, the great crowning glory is we will be with him, we will see him, he will wipe away our tears. It's that sort of intimate presence. And lastly, to try and... here I am trying to explain something I'm really... I know I haven't got a grip on yet, but I'm gripped by it and it's exciting. And I have to be quick so we've got time for questions. There's something strange and... for most religions of the world, wrong about this idea of God becoming one of us. The view of most people in spirituality is that really you need to escape this life. The spiritual... I've heard Christian people say this, which is absolutely flat wrong, which is why it's good to have the Bible to work out what's right and what's wrong. People speak about the body being a prison for the soul, and in death the soul is released. That is at best about a quarter truth. That's pure Greek philosophy and religion. I mean, I haven't got modern-day Greeks. I'm talking about the ancient Greeks of the time of Jesus. That's pure Greek philosophy. It's closely related to a lot of Eastern philosophy. The notion that life is about the escape from the physical. Spirituality, that's what it's about. The notion that there's something wrong with the physical. There are religions where if women are menstruating... if people have been to the bathroom, if a husband and wife have made love, they need to be specially washed before they can pray. And you've got to think, what does that saying about what God thinks about our humanness. If to go to the bathroom, which for frankly, I don't want to get too crass on this, it's his idea. We didn't make up the tube with the hole at either end. That's his idea, and it's a brilliant bit of construction. But if you say that to go to the bathroom, there's something about that that is fundamentally puts you out of tune with God, that is simply not the view of the Bible. You know, Jesus says, you know, what comes into the body goes out, doesn't make you clean or unclean. But Jesus not only becomes flesh, which I think indicates he thinks flesh is okay, but at the other end of his life, he dies and won't stay dead, and he doesn't float off into life eternal. The thing that the resurrection of Jesus doesn't show is that life goes on after death. Because what Jesus does is it is his body that is resurrected. People could touch him. He could eat fish. He kept saying, touch me and see, I'm not a spirit. He takes his body with him to heaven. And what it says is that when God chose to make human beings in a physical world, spiritual beings, physical beings, emotional beings, intellectual beings, he's still committed to that project. It's terribly broken, terribly damaged. He could well have said, oh, I've had enough of that. I've tried and tried with these clowns. It isn't working. He remains faithfully committed, which is part of when it says what we saw is grace and truth. The truth part in the Hebrew sense has the idea of faithfulness, not just statements that are true. It's loyalty. And God remains faithfully committed to this physical world, and he becomes a part of it. There ain't nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with being a human being, either male or female. There's nothing about being male or female that because of your body and your body fluids that make you somehow or other yucky in the presence of God. Human religion, yes. But in the eyes of God, no. I think Jesus becoming a human says to us, this is a good world we're in, tragically broken. It can be enjoyed and celebrated. It can be misused. But fundamentally, it's a good thing. And that's why God is happy to be enfleshed. Well, I'd like to keep going, but I should stop.
All right, take time, write down some questions. I'm sure you have some. Ian's always willing to take them from the floor, too, if you don't have time to write all that you want to know. Jeffrey will I'll go around and pick up any of those for you, just on the small slip of paper that's on the inside of your outline.
Firstly, in John chapter 1, verse 4, it speaks of Jesus being the light of all people. And the question is the light the Holy Spirit? I think I'd have to say probably not. It's talking about the work of the Logos, the Word. And I think what it's saying, the way Christians have, as they've studied this passage over the years, they take it that behind all true knowledge of the world lies the work and instruction of the Logos himself, that all truth belongs to God. That's where I think that's saying behind all the endeavours of human mind comes. It's because of the construction that we have from God, that we have these great minds and the encouragement to go and think and to play a part in creation. I don't think it's referring to the Holy Spirit there, but it wouldn't do you much harm if you thought it was. Flesh is good. What about fleshly desires? That is sin. Yes, there's a difficulty because there are parts in the letters in the New Testament written by the apostles, which is another word for prophets, really. They'll talk about the spirit being at war with sarx, which is the word, it's the flesh. And the flesh, it's like we use the word flesh ourselves in different ways. You can talk about, but here I think in when you read through, say, the Apostle Paul's letters where that comes out, Paul likewise shares a horror at what's called asceticism. The idea that the spiritual is found in not eating certain foods, in, you know, fasting and all that sort of stuff. It says that's not spirituality. That's human construction of religion. It's endemic in all religions. That's why people, sociologists, can study it. But the flesh is really just another, is Paul's way of talking about human nature turned in upon itself. Because the sins of the flesh include things like greed, right, which isn't what we'd normally think of as sin of the flesh. We think of sins of the flesh as fundamentally sexual or perhaps gluttony. But, you know, the sins of the flesh include things like envy, greed, unkindness. So it's a term that the Apostle Paul uses to mean humanity turned in on itself rather than turned out in love. So it is an understandable confusion if you just jump from John 1:14 to Galatians 5. But if you start at Galatians 1, you'll get what he's saying very clearly about what the flesh and the spirit mean. Now, we have time for about one more question. Any other questions from the floor, so to speak? No, all we have is no. And it's one of those things where you'd be surprised if you got it. What we do have, though, is in some of the early Jewish writings, the attack on Jesus because his mother was obviously a loose woman. And the implication seems to be that she'd had sex with a Roman soldier. So in part of the early hostility that there was against Christianity, there was an attack on the virgin birth story, which is understandable because there's a lot of heat in those early days. You may know, and you'll read this particularly on the days of the internet, which is so wonderful and so dumb sometimes. You know, you'll read all sorts of things, and it's in the internet, so it'll get said on SBS and ABC and other places as well. Oh, you know, every second man, his dog was virgin born. Genghis Khan is one I hadn't heard, that there's a legend. Now, decent historians rather than web clowns, an enormous amount of them. So Mithras was virgin born. No, actually, he was born out of a rock. It's great if people actually go back and read the documents. That Mithras was not virgin born. He was born from a rock. Now, subsequent to Christianity, way subsequent to it, some of the followers of Mithras said that he was virgin born. But prior to Jesus, he's born out of a rock. And there's this silly idea people have, it's a gross act of prejudice, that any time when you find something in Christianity that you can find anywhere else in the world, that Christians just nicked it. It never seems to cross people's mind that it goes the other way. So historians, when they deal with this very muted account of some sources that Genghis Khan was virgin birth, they know this is actually the legend writers of Genghis Khan finding any way you can say that our man is exceptional. Oh, goodness, Jesus was. Well, we'll have that too. A lot of the parallels to virgin birth, the Greek gods, etc., they're not at all parallel. In fact, the Greek gods with virgin birth aren't humans. Duh. And people say Hercules was virgin born. Well, Hercules, even the Greeks knew, was a myth. But the idea of a real woman in real space, real time, having a miraculously born child who is fully God and fully human, that is actually quite unique, and as is the whole thing with Jesus.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.